This is episode 101 of Social Entrepreneur with Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank.
I think that the banking sector is ripe with opportunity for change by individuals.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 101 of Social Entrepreneur with Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank. Kat spoke to me on the day that they had officially merged with Pan American Bank. And if you go back through history of when they first launched around 2007, there have been several mergers and acquisitions. And so they are really financially healthy. And here's the thing I really love about Beneficial State Bank. They have a social justice bent, and they achieve that through a financial sustainability business model. So several times in the interview, you will hear her say, beneficial to all and harmful to none. So can banking be a force for good? One of the phrases she uses in here, she says that banking is the original crowdfunding. When you think about it, we pool our funds together and then loans come out of that. And so there are like $12 trillion in deposits that if we make decisions to align our values with our deposits, or even more importantly, our deposits with our values, then think about the kind of impact that we could have. She also talks about migrating not just deposit capital, but also equity capital and human capital to align with our values. So just some fantastic stuff in here. Beneficial State Bank is a B Corp, a benefit corporation, and a Best for the World benefit corporation. They are also a CDFI. They have the Just label. They are a green bank. I mean, there are just so many things that you could say great about them, but I love her passion. I love how she thinks about moving our money and making an impact. So here she is, Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank.
Hi, I am Kat Taylor with Beneficial State Bank and Foundation. I am a co-founder and co-CEO of Beneficial State Bank, which is a triple bottom line bank attempting to change the banking system for good. We are a regulated community development financial institution taking deposits and lending money into communities and for the environment on the West Coast, serving Washington, Oregon, and California.
So a community development financial institution, are there certain requirements to be, and that's commonly called a CDFI, right?
Yes, there are. CDFIs are regulated by Treasury. It's a status that you apply for. It's hard to get and hard to keep. Right now, there are approximately 111 CDFI banks in the United States, and they must demonstrate that they are serving underserved communities with real metrics and a recertification reporting process on an annual basis.
So how does one go about co-founding a bank?
It doesn't happen every other day. I grant you that. We were engaged in a lot of other activities and very intrigued by the socially responsible banking sector. And then historic events in 2004 propelled us into the exploration of whether we could start a bank that could be part of the CDFI system. In an effort to reform banking to become an industry that benefited all and harmed none, at least as an ideal.
Okay, so say more about that. I mean, so it wasn't in 2004. It wasn't Beneficial State Bank, right?
Correct. It wasn't anything at that point. My husband and I were very involved in a number of progressive organizations, nonprofit organizations, democratic fundraising, and in particular with the John Kerry's campaign for president. So that was the momentous happening in 2004 is when we woke up the next morning and discovered he hadn't won after all. We accumulated our life work to date into an effort to research what sort of institution could bring progressive values to the American economy and therefore society at large. We did study institutions largely in finance because that's both our backgrounds. And we had been, it had been suggested to us sometime before that banking was a sector that could provide a huge amount of benefit, but was currently not. So we actually spent a couple of years learning from the great progressive banking institutions like Shore Bank in Chicago, Self-Help Credit Union in North Carolina and New York, and even the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. And the result of that exploration with about 15 other colleagues was we decided that we could help by starting a community bank, sort of 2.0, really a next generation bank that would serve within that community. We had no idea that we were, well, in 2004, we had no idea that we would be careening into the Great Recession along with all the other banks. But actually, part of the exploration was to discover that the extractive practices of banking were deeper and more widespread than even we feared. And we did get a glimpse of the mortgage crisis before it actually hit the public's awareness.
Yeah. So so what year did your Beneficial State Bank launch then?
In 2007, on June 27th, we put the FDIC insurance sticker in the window of One California Bank. That was the original name. It was named that to suggest that we're all in One California, and so we should act together in alignment with the public interest, sort of like we're all in one boat. And we proceeded to run the bank from that moment on, headquartered in Oakland, California, and expecting to serve California. Other historical events shortly thereafter brought us into league with other community banking institutions, some of whom were undergoing quite a bit of stress in the Great Recession. These recessions fall upon community institutions much harder. They're already in the effort to serve underserved communities and the environment in a commodity business with high overhead. We're already taxed quite a bit by the basic business model, and having the main banking system essentially shut down for a couple of years was very hard on the smaller community banks. So about 2010, just 3 years into our own journey, we were approached by the regulators about buying and combining with Shore Bank Pacific, which was South Shore Bank's West Coast subsidiary. South Shore Bank was deeply stressed by the recession, particularly with the amount of community commercial real estate it was holding. So we did agree over about a year period to purchase and combine the two banks, and that gave us our second name, One Pacific Coast Bank, because you clearly can't be called One California Bank if you're serving Portland, Seattle, and Oakland, and contiguous areas in those three states.
You changed your name in 2010 after merging with Shore Bank Pacific. Mm-hmm. Let me just pause on that for a second. So, first of all, if you're going to launch a bank, I mean, why not launch it right before the greatest credit crisis in all time, right?
Yeah. Well, in a funny way, we were lucky in our timing. We were so new, we didn't have many assets at all, much less sick assets. So we hadn't lent very much money, and we certainly had no mortgage exposure. We had been hoping to be half consumer, half commercial bank, consumer meaning serving individuals. And one strategy to do that would be to be a scaled mortgage lender. But that was out almost from the get-go because of the condition of the housing markets. So we were a happy little cash bank floating along the stormy seas, trying to make good commercial loans to businesses and nonprofits everywhere we could, quite small. It was really our opportunity to salvage the enormous value present in the community banking system anywhere we could. So we did buy Shore Bank Pacific and combined the two banks. We also salvaged quite a lot of value because Shore Bank Pacific had about a $12 million marked portfolio of loans that were distressed. And we chose to hold those loans and work with the borrowers, businesses and nonprofits, to right the ship and get them back on their feet. If you foreclose on loans and you shut businesses, there's an awful lot of collateral damage in the communities surrounding those businesses, from the release of their employees to the loss of their commercial spending in the community, et cetera. So we did hold those assets, and over time, a significant majority, if not preponderance or pretty much all of them, resolved to the benefit of the communities, the people who live nearby, and the environment. Shortly after coming together with Shore Bank Pacific and renaming the bank One Pacific Oaks Bank, we were approached by advocates for Albina Community Bank, another treasured community development financial institution bank in the Portland market, historically serving African American communities. Albina Community Bank was stressed because it couldn't raise additional capital at a time when bank regulations were requiring greater capitalization of the banks. We knew it offered enormous value to the communities that it served, and we didn't want it to go away. We spent about a year getting to know them and then agreed to purchase 90% of newly issued stock in the bank itself to recapitalize the bank. We kept that bank autonomous, partly because we don't own 100% of it, but also because we wanted it to be able to recover in place, assure its stakeholders that it was going to continue its very high standard business service in the markets. It has 5 branches in Portland, does a great job serving communities, individuals, and businesses and nonprofits. And so we've been operating side by side as sister banks since 2013, I believe. And then further in our own evolution, we met a bank called Finance and Thrift, serving the Central Valley since 1925. Primarily an auto lender, a very high road auto lender. Auto lending is fraught with all sorts of fraud and abuse, and Finance and Thrift was not only providing a very healthy auto loan product, but really lowering the cost of borrowing for working class families in need of transportation in the Central Valley, serving them very well. They have just this past fall purchased another legendary minority deposit institution called Pan American Bank. Pan American Bank was started in the 1950s by the family of the first Latina female Secretary of Treasury in the United States. Was serving Boyle Heights in East LA and communities nearby. Has a branch also in North Hollywood. So Finance and Thrift, the auto lender, got together with Pan American. They consolidated, merged together. And today, for us, is legal day one on the latest merger that we've undertaken, which is a full merger of Beneficial State Bank, which is the rebranded name for the bank serving the three West Coast states, and Finance and Thrift and Pan American Bank. So now we are able to offer quite a complete, not fully complete, but a nearly complete product set more deeply throughout the three West Coast states that get us back into scaled consumer markets. Finance and Thrift has currently about 13,000 auto loan borrowers, and over time, a consumer base of close to 50,000. So this is helping Beneficial State Bank broadly become both a consumer and a commercial lending bank, highly, highly mission-driven throughout and starting to infill important geographic territories for the bank's mission.
Yeah. Wow. That is quite the tale. And so congratulations on the mergers and acquisitions. And I I know a little bit about the difficulty of all that, and I can't imagine in a highly regulated environment that you're operating in that it could be any easier than anything I've ever seen. So, one of the things that, your story started with, though, was you were campaigning for, you were calling it progressive values. I've heard you in other places talk about social justice being sort of a core driver of what it is that you're trying to do. So first of all, I love that you're thinking of banking as a vehicle for social justice, environmental well-being, and financial sustainability. But when you think about social justice, give me kind of your top level definition of what that is.
The way we think about social justice, which we never separate from environmental well-being, is that we run our economy and our society in a way that distributes power, creates broad prosperity, and gives individuals a hefty dose of self-determination. It needs to be fully inclusive, racially and gender just, and environmentally restorative at this point, because we've degraded our natural capital base to our peril. If I think about my husband's mission is to act politically to avert climate disaster and restore broad prosperity, we are actually using a business model to do the same thing. And business models are deeply needed. It will not be possible for the philanthropic or social sector to overcome problems created by the economy and our business models. We have to do it right in the first place, in our view. So we chose a business model to complement the philanthropic efforts that we also engage in. But the primary driver of change in the bank model is the bank, the ability to use a leveraged, business disciplined, heavily regulated, recycling business model to get it right in the first place, to make sure people do have social justice and to make sure our natural commons are well stewarded.
So right now in the United States, we have this general election going on, or soon we'll have a general election going on. And there are times when, honestly, I just feel like an angry social justice warrior.
It's like, you're not alone, I don't think.
Yeah. So, but the thing that is in my mind is being angry isn't the solution, right? Fear and anger aren't going to solve our problems. So then the question is, for people who want to make an impact, and they're like, man, this is not headed the direction that I want to go. I want to turn this ship in a direction where we have this, sustainable economy that is good for all, that there's broad prosperity, that we're working in these underserved communities, et cetera. What can the average person do related to their banking that would move the needle in the direction of social justice?
Right. I think that the banking sector is ripe with opportunity for change by individuals. So if you think about banking as the original and most powerful form of crowdfunding, we've actually agreed to pool our deposits, our idle cash, in order to let the banking system finance the economy in which we want to live. And I would argue that's the new economy, the fully inclusive, racially and gender just, environmentally restorative, because we just wouldn't vote against ourselves and choose to live in some extractive economy that's bad for 99% of the people implicated. So if we look at it as crowdfunding, not that each deposit funds a specific loan, but all deposits fund a lending practice, we start to take power back. There's $12 trillion of deposit funding in the American economy. It's the lowest cost funding that the economy enjoys, other than extraneously weird forms of securitization. Our cost of funds at the bank right now is about 44 basis points. That's 44 one-hundredths of a percentage. That low-cost funding in abundance is gathered by the banks thanks to the privilege of FDIC insurance, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insurance. And that too is provided by American taxpayers in the end, because that's who backs up the insurance fund were it to fail. So we've been trained over decades as depositors to believe all we deserve is a pittance of an interest rate return, particularly where federal interest rates are right now, and no voice. But we actually should have the maximum voice among stakeholders of the banks, because we control at a minimum $9 out of $10 lent. That's our leverage ratio. We are allowed to use $1 of equity to collect $9 or $10 of deposits. That's a 10 times leverage ratio, 10% tier one capital. So we should respect our depositors much more, because it's really their money that we're lending. And that's before even you get to the much more complicated and even more powerful fractional reserve system of the American banking system, which is where credit is created and the money supply is further amplified. If we just stick to the simple deposit taking, we should really be listening to those depositors, and we should be awakening them to the voice that they can have. So you will recall that the Huffington Post launched a Move Your Money campaign at the height of the recession and foreclosure crisis, and it really resonated with people. You will remember Occupy as a movement that absolutely awakened people, but had a difficult time finding a focused set of action goals that we could all take up. That was because we didn't understand where those depositors, where people with their money in the big banks who were not serving them could turn to. But I would argue it's the community development banking system. So all depositors can place their deposits in alignment with their values. You can go to Treasury's CDFI website, and there's a map there of where those 111 banks are. So the first thing that anyone can do is simply take their money out of a bank that's not respecting their values and put it in a bank that is. If that's onerous, and the big banks actually make it very hard to withdraw your money in an easy and complete fashion, you can also amplify your voice at your financial institution. Say to them, here are these other banks are with a lending practice that I could be proud of, with corporate behaviors that I respect. I want you to act more like them, or I'm going to move my money. And the last thing is just to become part of a movement building among depositors to put the word out there that we all have more power, we should have more voice, and we can exercise it. Our theory of change starts with migrating deposit capital to values-aligned and driven banks, but it also includes migrating equity capital. We think we have actually quite a good business model for investors, particularly in the divest invest communities, to align their equity positions in banks like ours. And then last but not least, to migrate human capital from old banking practice to beneficial banking services. We have 7 to 10 interns every summer, young, talented people from high-ranking business schools and colleges who might never have thought they wanted to be a banker, but they get so turned on to the idea that they can change the world through a very strong business model that they come give us a try. So we need to capture the imagination of young people who want their work lives to be aligned with their values, and show them that learning banking skills like underwriting, risk management, sales and marketing, impact measurement, these are all skill sets of deep need in the aligned banking sector, and they're excellent jobs that are a lot of fun and actually put you in a position to change the world.
So instead of Teach for America, they could do Bank for America.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love that. So migrating the deposit capital, aligning our equity capital, and then moving our human capital towards social justice through the banking system.
Yes.
So all really interesting. Now, just one quick question about your impact. As you think about, how do we measure whether or not we're having an impact? How do you do that?
Sure. Well, that was not a system or a practice that was very well established when we started this. And we've been trying to be kind of on the leading edge of the movement to establish third-party auditable, credible, robust impact metrics for the banking sector. If you go to www.beneficialstate.org/impact, which is the foundation's wholly dedicated impact website, you will find quite a lot of information about our impact of theory of change, vision, mission, and also the development of metrics and where we're going. So the first thing we committed to was simply counting where our loan dollars land in the new economy on the basis of what they are producing, like affordable housing, renewable energy, sustainable food, or who's using them in alignment, like B corporations or worker cooperatives, or previously starved communities for capital, like low-income communities, small businesses, women and minority-owned businesses, the social sector, including nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And we made a commitment from the start that we would make sure that a preponderance of our loan dollars would always be in those hands, meaning 75% or more. And we also made a commitment that the other 25% would not be doing something to undermine our mission. They'd be sort of neutral. So we've been keeping those records since our origins. Well, not quite since our origins, but I think since at least 2012, may go back to 2011. And we add as often as we can to our ability to assess. So the next layer of metrics that we added was on outcomes. When those loan dollars are in those hands, what do they produce? How many renewable kilowatts financed? How many affordable units of housing added and preserved? How many living wage jobs with full benefits? And so we're tracking that and reporting as well on a quarterly basis. We also adopted radical transparency about our own behaviors. So we are a B corporation, second highest rated in the in America. We are a CDFI. We are just labeled, getting at our social justice practices as an American corporation. We measure our greenhouse gas, landfill, and water footprint and drive it down every year. We mitigate that which we can't drive down with real carbon credits. We pay 150% of living wage in all markets. And all of this is for a purpose. It's not only to make sure that we are chronically assessing our impact and making it as potent as possible, but also so that we can hold up to the world a bank model that's resiliently profitable, has all this impact, and is producing to the best of its ability benefit to all and harm to none. If you look at the major banks in the banking system, they are massive. They control 90% of bank assets, I think, are in the top seven banks. They are very, very powerful politically and economically. And they can show you a department in those banks that does the same kind of lending that we do, maybe even bigger, better, faster, stronger, because they command the lion's share of public subsidy. But they are dragging behind that a train of misery that has to stop. That's the harm to none ideal that we need to impose on the banking system. And I'll give you just a few highlights on that train of misery. Of course, the banks had a heavy hand in creating the mortgage crisis and now are doing the same in student loans and auto loans. They've been very, very leaning in to the fossil fuel economy. They've paid $250 billion of fines for abusing consumers, largely in credit card markets, without changing business practices because it's just seen as a cost of doing business. They're still quite lucrative lines. One third of bank tellers in the United States are on some form of public assistance, which is a shocking socialization of a private cost by some of the most profitable corporations in the world. And the harm of the banking system falls disproportionately harshly on low income and communities of color. So we need to stop that train of misery. And one of the ways we can do that is the migration of deposit equity and human capital to a better beneficial bank model, but also to awaken the constituents of those banks, that they can ask those banks to stop doing that, that we don't need to just take that lying down. And the way we do that is through radical transparency. We live for the day when all banks can make the kinds of commitments that we're making and uphold them because their practices are beneficial to all and harmful to none.
Well, Kat, I love this conversation. We could keep going for hours here, but we don't have hours. I really appreciate your perspective on this. So if people wanted to learn more about Beneficial State Bank, where would they look online or on social media?
We are in both the bank and the foundation case under www.beneficialstate.com or .org for the foundation. No bank in there. Bank is actually sort of a four-letter word in the American lexicon right now. And although we are a bank and proud of our regulatory status and embracing of our regulatory duties, we want people to focus on the beneficial state part.
So a call to action, as you think about people who have been hanging out with us today for the last half hour or so, what's one thing you would love for them to go and do as a result of having heard this conversation?
Well, thank you. First, just listening is wonderful because banking is boring, complicated, and mostly off of people's radar, but it's important. It's in all of our supply chains. It's our financial supply chain, and it's massive, very, very powerful. So listening and learning, thank you very much. The one action I think that's within everyone's grasp is if you are banking, make sure you're banking with a values-driven organization.
Very good. Well, Kat, thanks so much for being with us today on Social Entrepreneur.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we create Social Entrepreneur every Monday. Now, listen, I meant to say something at the top of the episode. I forgot to say it, that this episode reminds me of episode 25 with David Reiling of Sunrise Banks and episode 26 with Joseph Sandberg of Aspiration. So I'll put links to those in the show notes. If you'd like the show notes for today, just head over to tonyloyd.com/101. That's TONYLOYD, tonyloyd.com/101. Now listen, thanks so much for being with us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.